Hi everybody, my name is Spencer and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober today. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me back. I was trying to think of, about what I wanted to share in relationship to what I shared last week. And for those of you that were here last week, I talked a lot about my spiritual experience and the spiritual experience that I had as a result of doing the steps. For me, the big book, I came to the big book, I was reading the big book as soon as I got into AA. I was in a meeting, it was a 7-day-a-week meeting, that every day of the week was like a different thing. So you'd read the big book, you'd read the step book, there was a speaker, there's like every day was different. And so I'd read the book like on repeat for the first maybe 2 years. But a lot of the stuff in the book, I didn't ever go through it with somebody, and a lot of the stuff like didn't stick out to me. I mean, I read it, but I didn't necessarily hear it or maybe understand it. And it wasn't until I was about 3.5 years sober that I went through the book with somebody sort of line by line and had this really transformative experience of the book. The thing is that at that point, I had already had a very transformative spiritual experience that had started right away when I got to AA as a result of me going through the steps. And I went through the steps with a sponsor. So the big book for me wasn't so much a instruction manual detailing like what I was supposed to do. It was more like a roadmap that actually showed, like it showed what had happened to me. I mean, it was like it had already happened. And then I was reading this book that was like, wait a second, this is actually describing what has happened to me. Not just like what my drinking was like, because it did a pretty good job of describing that too. But it was like it's describing in this book what has happened to me, how I had this transformation, and then what my life is like now since I've had this transformation. And I remember being in a meeting one time and somebody talking about this idea of the fourth dimension. And there's two times I think in the book where they say it. One time is in Bill's story. He talks about it's right before he sort of describes his description of his worst bottom, and he's like, little did I know that I was soon to like enter into this fourth dimension of existence. And then he says it later again on page 25. In this paragraph, which I love, it starts with, "There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we'd come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed." And so much of that paragraph and so many of these paragraphs in the book like speak to that, the experience that I had. I remember that hopelessness and futility of life as we've been living it. And I remember I was a very dramatic drinker, right? So I've got stories that are like, I broke into a Starbucks at 4 o'clock in the morning. The guy that was delivering milk had propped open the door, and he was in like the back delivering cartons of milk. And I walked into the Starbucks, went behind the counter, and started making myself a drink. I don't even drink coffee. I don't know what I was making. And the guy smartly like ran out the front door, shut it, and locked it, and then called the police. So the police got there. I was sitting at the table eating cookies from Starbucks, drinking a glass of milk, and they were not happy. They pulled me out, hands over the head on the ground, pulled me out at gunpoint, dragged me into the street. And that was like another Tuesday night. You know what I mean? Like that stuff happened to me all the time. That I would get arrested, I would end up in the hospital, I would fall down the stairs, just sort of constantly these like really dramatic consequences of my drinking. And I remember you know, one time talking to my sister-in-law, and I was telling her some story about it was the first time actually that I'd ended up in the hospital. I was 17, and I was going to this big concert. It was like a big festival, summer festival concert at a big stadium. And you couldn't bring an alcohol. I mean, you couldn't bring an alcohol even if you were over 21, but I wasn't anyways. So the night before, I figured out this plan where I went to the hardware store. I bought 6 feet of plastic tubing, 1-inch plastic tube. And I filled it, fit a half gallon of vodka in the 6-foot tube. And then I got corks for either end, corked it, wrapped it around my body, and then tied it to myself with shoelaces. It's like ingenious, you know what I mean? Like if I spent that much time thinking about anything else other than alcohol, I would be a billionaire. You know what I mean? Like I have a mind that's just like willing to go to any length to figure out how to like get alcohol. And but I got into the concert and somebody dared me basically. You know, they just gave me some like, well, what are you going to do with all that? You going to drink it? You can't drink all that. And I was like, yay! I barely needed it, a prompt, but since you gave it to me. So I lay down on the ground, and I put one end of the tube in my mouth, and I had somebody hold up the other end of the tube, and I chugged just about as much of it as I could. I mean, there was a lot of it ended up like on my face, but I chugged an awful lot. And within about, I don't know, 20 minutes, you know, it was starting to hit, and I went into a blackout. I fell. I sliced my nose open, and friends, I guess, you know, this is all stories from them, but they took me to the first aid, and by the time I got into first aid, my body was, like, going into shock, from alcohol poisoning, and I was probably like 115 pounds. I mean, I was like a little kid, you know. I was like 17 years old, but I was a late bloomer. Like I was still like a little kid, 17, you know. And so they took me. They rushed me to the hospital. Paramedics took me in the ambulance, rushed me to the hospital. The first piece of it I remember is coming to, and I've been belligerent, so they had put restraints on, so I was attached to the bed, and I had IVs in my arm, and you know, faces covered in blood, and my parents are standing at the end of the bed crying, because I was 17, so they called them, and they come, and I'm telling my sister-in-law this story. This is like I've been sober for years at this point, and I'm telling her this story, and her face like starts to go a little bit pale, and she's like, "Oh my God, this is so crazy, like, I have this exact same story. I went to this, my first weekend of college, I went to this keg party, somebody dared me to chug a bottle of vodka, I chugged it, I fell, I hit my head, they had to call the ambulance, I got rushed to the hospital, I woke up with the IVs in my arm, my parents were at the end of the bed crying, and she's like, "Do you think I'm an alcoholic?" And I was like, "Did it ever happen to you again?" She was like, "No." And I was like, "Yeah, probably not." That was the first time I went to the hospital, right? And what makes me alcoholic, as I understand it, is my inability to learn from those experiences, right? That there is nothing that can happen to me. There is no consequence of my drinking that's bad enough to make me stop. And that's what it means for me to be powerless over alcohol. And, you know, part of the thing I realized when I got here was that you know, the worst thing or worst things that had happened to me when I was drinking weren't the last things. And that was really like, that was a good way for me to understand the insanity of alcoholism. Because there was a couple of stories in particular, like there was a time I was down in New Orleans and my sister went to school down there and we went out to this bar to celebrate her graduation. And I disappeared. I sort of got lost from the group I was with. Have no idea what happened. I have a few vague memories that are pretty scary anyways. Like maybe had a gun pulled on me and a drug deal. That, you know, that kind of stuff. It was always just like vague, like, ooh, I think that was not good, you know. But basically, my night was like, left the bar with them, not sure what happened, bunch of sketchy stuff. And then the next thing, I'm like on the curb in this not great neighborhood in New Orleans, just sitting on the curb by myself. And it's like 8 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like, I have no idea how I got here, where I am. My phone doesn't work. Like, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I ended up walking. She'd been a student at Tulane. I ended up finding the campus, you know, after kind of a long hike. I found a security guard there. I was so pathetic, like, in my appearance that I think she just believed me. They do not give out, like, personal information of students to just random people. And I think I just was, like, pathetic enough that I convinced her that what I was saying was true. And she gave me my sister's address. And so I could walk to my sister's house. And, you know, it wasn't a great night. We had to go to, like, breakfast with my parents. It was not, you know, it's not my best look. But I didn't think much of it other than, like, it had been, like, oops, again, you know, didn't mean to do that. And about 2 weeks later, my sister called me and she said, you know, I was at a party the other night and I overheard these people talking and telling this story about how they left Snake and Jake's, which was the bar that we've been at. They said they left Snake and Jake's and they were all drunk. They got in their car to leave and they were pulling out of the parking spot. And the parking lot at Snake and Jake's is like, I think it was like an overflow lot. It was just a grass field, basically. And they were pulling out, and one of the people in the back seat saw something in the mirror and said, "Wait, wait, 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 stop!" And they got out of the car, and I had passed out behind their car, and my head was in the tire rut where they were backing out into inches from the tire. I mean, just inches. And that was not the last time I drank. Even hearing that story was not the last time I drank. I mean, I probably drank when I heard that story. You know what I mean? That story makes me want to drink. But what was so crazy about that story, and really, like, I think planted a seed in my head, is that so many of the terrifying things, I was a blackout drinker, so many of the terrifying things that happened to me when I was drinking, I probably never knew. It was just like, I mean, I had all these horror stories of things that had happened to me that were, like, really bad. But then I was like, oh, man. I have, like, all these other horror stories that, like, somebody didn't just, like, coincidentally overhear at a party. You know? The fact that that news got back to me is, like one in a million that I'd ever even hear that story. And it was scary. You know? I remember being, like, really scared at that point in my life. I was scared of what happened to me when I drank. I was scared of what was going to happen to me. And still, like, total casual ease, I would just, like, well, yeah, it's scary, but it's Tuesday. There's nothing else to do, you know? It'll be different. I'll eat more bread this time, you know? Or drink more water, or rotate, you know, or switch liquor, or whatever. Only spend $20, or, you know, like, every rule I had, like, I would just blow through it. And but in some ways, this sort of, like, you know, the most kind of profound moment of desperation for me was actually the most subtle. I was, you know, just bringing it back to this thing I just read, this moment, you know, this believing in the hopelessness and futility of life. I was sitting on the couch at my parents' house. My family had just had an intervention for me. And I thought that they did the intervention completely wrong. Like, they just, like, I was just, like, such a failure. I mean, I was, like, trying to direct them, basically. And this is what I do for a living, is direct. But I was, like, trying to do it, like, in the intervention. I was, like, that's not alcoholism. You know what I mean? Like, my dad was, like, describing to me what he thought the problem was. And I'm, like, you got it wrong. I thought the lighting was bad. They could have picked a different location. You know, there's a lot of problems that I had with it. But after that moment, I was sort of sitting there, and I remember having this feeling. And they talk about it other places in the book. Like, like this sort of these two, this moment, this pivotal moment, right? It was like I was either going to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my existence, right? I was either going to keep doing that, or I was going to, what the book calls, accept spiritual help. I didn't have that vocabulary. I don't think I would have called it spiritual help at that time. But in retrospect, what I think I would call it is a willingness to accept the possibility that I don't know the answer to my own problem. And that's how I understand spiritual help, right? As differentiated from material help, which is like the stuff I understand, right? You need material help is like, I'm going to like give you money, or I'm going to provide a solution that's like a very practical or logical solution to this problem. Spiritual help is this other category for me, right? It was like something that was unknown. It was like in the absence of my own idea about how to solve this thing, I was willing to accept that maybe there was a solution I hadn't considered. And that was really the beginning for me of my journey into AA and into recovery. I've heard people describe that as step zero. Sometimes they say, you know, step one is really accepting powerlessness and understanding that we're powerless over alcohol. But step zero is that like that tipping point, right? Where we're just like we're just willing enough to sort of say like, okay, like maybe I don't know how to do this, and maybe there is a solution that I haven't considered. So, you know, here I am, right? Approached by those in whom the problem had been solved. There's nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. And that's what I did. You know, not like super enthusiastically at first, but certainly like pretty much from the jump. I saw people in both in the outpatient rehab that I went to and then ultimately in AA when I got there a couple weeks later. I saw people who had what I wanted. Like they were people that looked happy and they told stories like crazy drinking stories that sounded like the crazy drinking stories that I had. And they also had lives and they were doing stuff that was like, I want that. I want a family. I want a job. I want to live in the world. And so I was willing to, what this says, like pick up this kit of spiritual tools laid at my feet. And so I started, you know, I got a sponsor, I did the steps. And like I said, as a result of the steps, I started to have this really transformational experience. And then what happened is the part I wanted to talk about tonight, is that I was rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, which I had not even dreamed of. And I think, in theory, that sounds great, and there's a lot of stuff that's wonderful about that. But if you also think about it from the perspective of somebody who is like fully inequipped to handle life in any dimension, all of a sudden finding themselves in the fourth dimension, right? It's a little bit terrifying. Right? And that was my experience. My experience was that like all of a sudden, pretty young and pretty early in sobriety, I had this life that was like huge and amazing and full of like possibility and full of coincidence and also full of tragedy and also full of frustration and also full of like very high expectations of what I should be getting, you know, all the time, being met with reality, which was like, didn't meet up with those expectations. And so all of this stuff that happens to us in AA, and what I needed were all of the steps that come after that first 4 through 9, where we have this mechanism of transformation, right? What I needed were those steps 10, 11, and 12 that help us find our orbit in that fourth dimension. You know, find a way to live and continue to live in that space that we up until that moment, at least for me, had been completely unfamiliar with. You know, like I just didn't know what to do in the spiritual realm. You know, it just felt like, I mean, not at first. At first, it's like, I don't know, some people maybe call it like a pink cloud, or like, people always say like, oh, you're on fire, You know, and that's what it feels like. You just have this, like, my whole body. I remember that first year and a half in sobriety, like, I'd just walk outside and it was like, things like looked a different color. You know, it was just like, oh my God, like, it's like different. You know, and then all of a sudden you're like, okay, but now it's like, now I have to go to work. You know what I mean? And I have to, like, get on the train. And I have to do, like, very regular things and have relationships. And, you know, I'm, like, making amends to people, right? I had these, like, totally transformative experiences, like, making amends and having these, like, heartfelt moments of this thing. Then you have to see the person again and just, like, be nice to them, you know, and have, like, a regular relationship with them, you know? And I think that was a challenge for me because so much of my life had been lived in this, like, really super dramatic way. And so the idea of... I was actually pretty good at making amends. I built them up. I mean, I really thought that they were going to be very different. I mean, I remember getting this... I felt like I needed to make amends to paramedics when I got sober, because I had a lot of experiences where I treated them very badly on many, many occasions. And I talked a lot to my sponsor about, like, well, what would that look like? What should I do? What's a good way to make amends to paramedic? And he said, well, you know, think about it. Come back to me. Let's talk about it. And I came back to him. I said, you know, I think I want to become an EMT. I think I want to train and work as an EMT. And I think that would be a really good way to make an amends. And he was like, yeah, that's great. I mean, it's a little self-indulgent, right? Like, you get to be the hero in this story, but who am I to stop you? Like, you know, go for it. I think it sounds great. Whether it works as the amends or not, like, you should definitely do that. And so I showed up to the rescue house, and because I had something weird, I mean, health insurance is so crazy. So because I had acknowledged that I was an alcoholic, which happened when I went to rehab, the way that my insurance had to pay for that, I had to, like, say on some form somewhere that I was an alcoholic, it, like, triggered this, like, insane, like, insurance thing where they didn't want to treat me because it was a pre-existing condition. They didn't want to cover me because alcoholism was a pre-existing condition and I was, like, switching insurance. And anyways, it became, like, this big thing. And when I was going through trying to do the EMT training, the doctor was like, I can't, because you're an alcoholic, you have to go through all of this special, we have to go through all this special process to determine whether or not you're going to be fit to be an EMT. And I was like, this is insane. If I had come a year and a half ago as a full-blown alcoholic, you would have just let me in. You know what I mean? And now, just because I admitted it, I have to go through this, like, really long, drawn-out process of, like, different kinds of exams and, like, all the sign-off from, like, a psychiatrist, like, all this stuff. I did it, right? I was, like, committed to it. I'm going to do it. But what it meant was that all these other people that I had started this EMT training with at the rescue house, they were getting to start right away. They had got their clearance, and they were getting on the ambulance and going out at night and rescuing people or whatever you do on an ambulance. And I was staying at the station and cleaning the toilets. And for weeks, while I waited for my medical clearance, this is what I would do. I would show up to the rescue house, and I would help make dinner, and then I would clean the bathrooms. And I hated it. You know, this is, like, not at all the glory that I was. I wanted to be on, like, the front page of the paper, pulling some kid out of a tree. You know what I mean? Like, that was the kind of amends I had in mind. And it didn't happen. I mean, they just cleaned that toilet for, like, months. And but it did start to feel like an amends. You know, it was sort of like, oh yeah, this actually, this feels more appropriate maybe than me being a hero. It's me being of service. And so anyways, I kept showing up, and I finally got to ride in the ambulance. It was my first night. I'm going to ride in the ambulance, and you do these, like, the volunteers do, like, an overnight. I don't know if it's like that in New Jersey, but this is in Maryland, and you do, like, an overnight. And, so your shift is 7 PM to 7 AM. So you have dinner with everybody, maybe go out on a couple, you know, little calls, whatever. But then usually sort of in the middle of the night, that's when these, like, big, you know, traumatic calls happen. So we got a call at 2 o'clock in the morning. Drunk driver flipped a car, crashed into a pole. We show up. Car is completely totaled, upside down, smashed into this telephone pole. And the driver was 20 or 21. The passenger was like same age, 19 or 20. They both like got out of the car. You know, they like climbed out the window. They were both like okay. But they were pretty bruised and like beat up, and they needed to go to the hospital and get checked out. But the guy, the kid that was driving, like super belligerent, just like angry. So my job was to get this kid and hold him down onto the gurney while the paramedics strapped him down, right? And he's driving down, and I'm like standing above him, and I like pick up the gurney to put him into the ambulance. And he looks up at me, sticks both middle fingers up in the air, and he goes, "Fuck you!" And this like wave of peace just like rushed over. I mean, it's hard to even explain. It was just this like, I felt like everything was right in the universe. You know, it just was like, it was like, oh, this was exactly where I was supposed to be in exactly the moment that I was supposed to be there. You know? So anyways, you could tell by my experience of these amends, I have like, I mean, I had a police officer that I had to make amends to, and I couldn't get in touch with him. He was in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, and I was in Brooklyn, and I couldn't get in touch with him, but I found out through somebody else in the office that what day he worked, and that was all they'd tell me, just like what day and what hours or whatever. So I drove from Brooklyn to Uniontown, Pennsylvania. I think it's like a 10-hour drive or 12-hour drive. It's at the far western corner of Pennsylvania. So I drove all the way across New Jersey, all the way across Pennsylvania, and got there. And I walk in, and it's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I walk into this office, and they're like, "Oh yeah, no, Officer Smith, he's gone for the day." And I had all the way, this entire drive out to Pennsylvania, I had been like making up this story about how when I made amends to him, he was going to, this is great, I have a very vivid imagination. Okay, he was going to be so grateful to me for making this amends, and he was going to be so happy to see me. And he also had an alcoholic son, this is the story I have, right, and who was like 25, and he was going to be like, "Could you come talk to my alcoholic son?" And I was going to go to dinner at his house. I literally didn't even plan what I was going to have for dinner that night because I was so certain that this police officer was going to invite me over to have dinner at his house and talk to his alcoholic son about AA. Or maybe it was a gay son and he was going to introduce me and I'd get married. Like there was sort of like, it was like competing storylines, right? It was either like I was going to like fall in love and marry him, or I was going to save him, you know, from a, you know, painful alcoholic death. And I got there and he was like not there. And so the whole story just comes crashing down, right? I'm like, oh, this is like ruined. And I think actually that would have been a better ending. Like if that was the end of it, I think I would have walked away, just being like, well, next time, then I'll save his life or whatever I was going to, you know, plan to do. And instead, as I was leaving, this guy is walking up in the parking lot, and I saw his, you know, I was certain I would recognize him. It was a cop I had attacked while I was drunk, and I was certain I, like, must know what this guy looks like. And I see this guy who I have absolutely no recollection of, and he looks at me, and he recognizes me. And I see his name badge, that's this guy, and I said, "Hi. You know, I'm here to, sorry to catch you at work and in the parking lot, but I'm here to make an amends to you." And I went through my amends, and he goes, "Great, well, thank you very much, and hope you have a good day." And he walked away, and I was like crushed. I was crushed. I mean, I couldn't believe it wasn't met with more fanfare or like it, or at least some acknowledgement that I had like made this long trip. I don't even think he asked, "Where did you drive in from?" You know, so there's this sort of like, right, this is the fourth dimension, right, is that we're having like these really extraordinary, what I would call sort of spiritual experiences that are very enlightening, beautiful, sort of incredible things happening. And at the same time, they're matched with these like kind of the insanity of the mind, right? Like that insanity hasn't left, right? So I'm still in this world where, like, you know, I'm having this, what I would call a transformative spiritual experience, but I'm not necessarily able to navigate that spiritual experience with the tools that I have. And so the 10th and the 11th step, and ultimately the 12th step, have been really, really important for me to be the tools that help me navigate that spiritual experience that I'm now having, right? And to continue to, like, nourish that spiritual experience that I'm having. And I, you know, for me, I think the, you know, 10 and 11, which I sort of do together, I think the thing that was really hard for me to understand about the 10th and 11th step was that they were going to be something that I always needed to do, and that felt like such a failure to me. You know, it felt like every time I had to do a 10th and 11th step where I, you know, had to go back to somebody and apologize for something I had done that day, or I had to, like, do an inventory and see where I had been fearful or selfish or dishonest. Like, every time I went back to that, I felt like I had somehow failed. And, you know, it wasn't until, talking to somebody who I think, who explained it like a bath or a shower. And that, like, right, they said, like, imagine you have, you know, a 7-year-old kid, right? They'll call him Johnny. Johnny comes home after a long day outside, and Johnny says, you guys say, Johnny, it's time to take a bath. Well, I took a bath yesterday. Yeah, I know, but you're dirty. You have to take a bath again. You have to take a bath every day. Well, was I not supposed to get dirty? No, it's okay. It's like, well, it's what happens. That's what happens when you live in the day, right? Is that you get dirty. That's what happens. But that's not how I think of my defects of character. Like, I think of my defects of character as, like, I was not supposed to do that. Like, that the 11th step is happening because it was something that I had, like, done wrong, and now I am, like, fixing what I have done wrong. Not this awareness that the 10th and the 11th step are inevitable because being alive results in all of these defects of character that need to be washed off. And that was for me a totally different way to understand my relationship to those disturbances. Because up until that point, like, I had the disturbance, and then I had, like, the disturbance about the disturbance. And so much of, like, the painful stuff in my life, in sobriety, hasn't been the disturbance. It's been the disturbance about the disturbance. It's been the feeling of shame, or the feeling of fear, or that heaviness that comes as a result of feeling like I wasn't supposed to. When the reality is that, like, those disturbances are the thing that have given me everything. I have a friend that said, why is it that I despise the defects of character that bring me to the feet of my Creator? Why is it that I despise those things which bring me to the feet of my Creator? Because that fear and that envy and that shame are the things that are, like, ultimately inspiring me to, like, reignite my spiritual search, like, look again for that connection, right? And when I understand those disturbances as cyclical, right, you cannot be awake 24 hours a day. It doesn't make any sense, right? Nobody wants to be awake 24 hours a day. And I don't think that you could be spiritually awake 24 hours a day. The point is that I go through the night or the season, right? All of those things that are cyclical, right? Whether it's day to night, whether it's like the orbit, whether it's like the dark side of the moon, right? All of those things that we understand to be cyclical. My relationship to those disturbances are the same. That I go through this period where I fall asleep spiritually. I'm a spiritual narcolep, right? It's just part of human nature, is to like just fall asleep spiritually. It's not, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm not broken. That is like literally how I'm made, is to fall asleep spiritually. And those disturbances are my alarm clock. So they are not the indication that I have done something wrong and have now have to repent for it. They are in fact the indication that I am in exactly the right place and now is the time to start. Right? I don't have a relationship to my alarm clock when it goes off and I'm like, oh, I messed up again. I slept through the night. This is horrible. How could I have done this? I'm such a bad person. It's just the alarm clock goes off and I say, like, it's time to get up. It's time to get up and start my day. It's time to do what I do. Right? And my relationship now to anger, to fear, to shame, to all of those things is the exact same way. When I get angry about something, I don't think, oh, you know what? I have been like off my spiritual game. I have like didn't meditate. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. Instead, I like get angry and I go like, oh, good. Right on time. I know what to do. I know what to do as a result of this anger. I know what to do when I feel afraid. What I do is I return to that practice. And even if that's like in an hour, I forget, which happens. I have 5-year-old twins. It happens all the time. I can literally turn my back and I have forgotten. I have fallen spiritually asleep in that period of time. You know, like I yell at them and I'm like, I'm not going to yell. This is good. We're all fine. They're children of a loving God. I am here as a patient and kind father. And then I like turn around and I turn back. I'm like, what is wrong with you? You know, like, and that's fine. And then it like, if the cycle is just like shorter, right? That's all. It's still a cycle, right? It's all still that cycle. And so what I'm looking to do is extend that cycle, right? Make a little, give it a little more space in those times. And I'm also looking to like refine that transition between those times, right? Wake up well, right? Wake up. And so knowing that like my spiritual practice, if I keep a regular spiritual practice, right? Rather than a reactive spiritual practice, right? Meaning like a reactive spiritual practice is like, I don't have a spiritual practice and then something happens and I'm like, I better get a spiritual practice, right? That's a reactive one. But a regular spiritual practice is then I'm like, I'm already in the groove. Like as those things are happening to me, I already know what to do with those things. I had a situation at work, happened to me not too long ago. I had a probably the biggest thing in my career that's ever happened. It was like the best news I'd gotten. It was like going to be huge. It was likely would have been some sort of a life change experience, right? And I had it for it was about 6 weeks when it was like, it was there, it was happening, it was like, and then in one day, one tweet actually, I think it was, the whole thing went away, right? I was, I work in television and I sold a show. It was a huge show. It was a big deal. We had talent attached to it. The talent ended up in some legal trouble that all came out in a series of headlines over a 24-hour period, and everything was canceled. Like, everything connected to the show was canceled. And, that is, like massively disappointing, you know? And, like, there's so many pieces of it going on. It's, like, embarrassing, you know, because like it's sort of publicly people know that I was doing this. It's like disappointing. It's for me, things in like that get really like I attach them I give them all this meaning, right? I know we all do this, right? I assign all this meaning. So instead of it just being about like the show or the thing, It was like what it said about me as a person, right? As my career. Like, it went from being like, I am a successful television producer who sold a show to like, I am a failure and I've always been a failure and I will always be a failure. It's just like, wow. And like, that took like 90 seconds. You know what I mean? Like, to go from like, where I was like, everything is great. I have the best career. I'm so happy. Everything I've ever done has led to this moment, and everything I do from here on out will be the best thing that ever happens, to literally, you have always been a failure and you will always be a failure. And what's great is that I knew exactly what to do with that. You know, I knew that those feelings weren't the truth. And I knew that that all I needed to do was take the disturbance that I was feeling, and in that 10th and 11th step process, put it back through the mechanism of the steps, and that whether it was immediate or not, eventually I would be restored to a feeling of serenity and peace, right? And the other thing, which happened, by the way, it took weeks, but it happened, right? I kept doing it. I kept going back and doing, because it had a lot of different like angles and faces and nuance, right? But I kept going back to that process, and then eventually, like, I had that experience of serenity and peace. But the other thing, as I've stayed sober longer, that I've come to be, you know, really appreciative of, is that the mechanism of the steps is not intended, I don't think, to fix sadness. Right? Sadness is not what I would consider a defect of character. It's an appropriate emotional response to the world that's disappointing us, you know, or when something happens that is sad. And so what I was able to do in the steps is like process all of those feelings of like feeling like a failure, feeling like nothing ever good was going to happen again, right? So despair, fear, low self-worth, all of that, but not mask or attempt to mask the feeling of profound sadness, which I was. It just sucks. It sucks that it happened. It sucks that I don't get to have this experience that I really wanted to have. And be okay with sitting with that sadness, because it wasn't what I'd always experienced before, which is like sadness plus all these other things, right? And those things get swirled up in a way that you cannot disconnect them. They feel like all the same ball of thing. And so people are telling you to like, you know, they don't understand why you're crying about, you know, about something. And now it's just like, you know, people would ask me about how I was doing, and I could say like, I'm sad. It's really sad that this all turned out this way. And that experience of that regular 10th and 11th step process has been the way that I stay prepared for that kind of moment. You know, I think the other thing in that whole, there was a moment about a couple weeks after we found out that the show was going to be canceled. There was an opportunity. I'm not going to say any name, so I'm not worried about this being recorded. But there was an opportunity for me to make some dramatic changes to how the show would have been and keep it alive, right? But I would have had to. I would have taken a lack of integrity. Right? I would have had to like do some things that I had said I wouldn't do, and I would have had to be dishonest, and I would have had to like do some other things. And the thing that's so great about what we have in AA and what I found there is that we have this set of principles, and if we're ever in doubt or find that our intuition has been lost or somehow like invisible to us in that moment, we can always like check our actions based on those principles. And if our action lines up with those principles, then like we're in pretty good shape. Even if we're uncertain about what the intuitive thing to do, right? And it wasn't like I didn't have time to wait for an intuitive thought. I was on the phone. Somebody said, do you want to make this happen? And I was able to go like, you know, check through my list of principles. Is that honest? No. Does that have integrity? No. Is that compassionate? No. Great. Well, that's three. You know, I could check it against some other principles, I guess. But like, you know, three that were definites and are pretty good, you know, indications of what's appropriate and not. Like, it's a relief to have that kind of like that almost like safety net. You know, and that's what I think when we're talking about this fourth dimension. I don't know actually what Bill was talking about when he said the fourth dimension. I mean, I think the fourth dimension at an amusement park is like they spray water in your face when you're in the movies, right? You go to like a 3D movie that's in 4D, you're going to get like wind blown on you when you're in the convertible, yeah. Right? Like that's 4D. Then there's like Einstein's fourth dimension, which is time, I think. But then there's like what I think he's probably referring to, because it was sort of around a lot at the time that they're writing this book, is this the dimensions of the spiritual existence. So they had like these different, they would refer to these, like they refer to the fourth dimension in the Bible, right? And they talk about the fourth dimension being a place of like the spiritual plane or like the intuitive plane, right? It's the realm outside of the material, right? So that doesn't necessarily match up with like some of the other understanding. And now I think there's like 26 dimensions or something. I mean, it's like, it's not the same, right? It's not like it could take, you know, translate this exact phrase, you know, exactly how he meant it. But that's sort of how I interpret it. Right? It's this idea that like the fourth dimension of existence is beyond what is immediately conceivable in my world, right? Like the world that I can touch, the world that I can see, the world that I can interact with in that way. Right? That was the world that I was living in. And the fourth dimension for me is like the world that exists beyond our immediate understanding or knowing. Right? It's that place that we don't know or can't explain, but are willing to expand our mind to imagine that things might not be exactly as we know them or understand them. And, you know, I used to go to this meeting, this meditation meeting, and it was, they always did this, like, at the beginning of the meeting, they'd always say, okay, well, we're going to go into our meditation, and we want everybody to breathe in love and breathe out fear. I went there for a couple weeks and I was like, this doesn't sit right with me. And after about like a couple months of this, I realized, I was like, oh, I think I just don't like the idea of being in a room with everybody's fear. You know, that this is like, that's what you're putting out into the world. And I got it. Like, right, I get what they're doing. Like, you're like getting rid of the fear. But I think it's different. I think that's actually like, I don't think that's exactly what we do in AA. I think that what we do in AA is we take in fear, right? We take in all of this incredible, real, and scary stuff that happens. We take in all of this disappointment, like losing this job, or you know, what it's like to be a parent, or what it's like to not be a parent, or what it's like to have expectations, or like all these things that happen in the world and in our lives in this third dimension, right? Like we take all of this stuff in. And then through this spiritual mechanism of the steps, through this regular practice of doing the 10th and 11th step, of doing that inventory, of making amends, of being of service to other people, through that process, we transform that fear, that anger, the shame, right? All of that stuff in the world, we transform it into love. And that's what we give to the world. Right? We're like the photosynthesis of love. We're taking in all this things that is unusable and we're putting back out something that is. You know, and that has been my experience of living in this fourth dimension of existence. Is that all I was capable of before I got here was taking right? That was all I could do. I couldn't offer anything because I was so consumed with the idea that I needed, I was afraid I wasn't going to get, I didn't trust you, I didn't know what the future was going to hold, right? And that is all, for the most part, gone. And what happens to me now is that I can go into the world and no matter what happens, whether it's scary, whether it's disappointing, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, that I take in that experience, whether it's mine or yours, I take that experience in, and through this process, this spiritual transformation that happens through the steps, through a connection to a power greater than myself, then what I bring back to the world is love. And, you know, who has time for a cocktail when you when you're busy making love? So that's all I got for tonight. Can't wait to hear from you guys. Thanks.
Okay, show of hands. Any questions or comments?